1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Christopher Cruz. A trade war is escalating.
The tariffs are 10% against Chinese goods and 25% against goods from Mexico and Canada. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says his country will not sit idly by.
Canada will be responding to the U.S. trade action with 25% tariffs against $155 billion worth of American goods.
The Prime Minister said for starters, those goods would include Florida orange juice, Tennessee whiskey, and Kentucky peanut butter. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, Washington.
Those products come from states represented by Republican senators. Gas Buddy's Patrick DeHaan expects the tariffs will quickly increase the cost of gasoline in four regions of the country.
The Great Lakes, the Rockies, the Midwest for crude oil tariffs, and the Northeast for tariffs on refined product.
It's the question we're all asking. What caused an Army helicopter and a passenger plane to collide in midair this week near Reagan National Airport? Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has a lot of questions. He spoke on CNN.
The position of the Black Hawk, the elevation of the Black Hawk. Were the pilots of the Black Hawk wearing night vision goggles? Did it affect their peripheral vision or their perception?
This morning, families of some of the 67 victims walked along the banks of the Potomac River. The FAA, meanwhile, has heavily restricted helicopter traffic around the airport. Philadelphia Mayor Sherelle Parker says the number of people injured on the ground when a medical plane crashed in northeast Philadelphia Friday night has increased.
That number has now increased to 22. Five of the victims remain hospitalized currently, and three of them are in critical condition.
The six people on the plane, all from Mexico, were killed, as was a person in a car. Keith Siegel, an Israeli-American, was among the three hostages released this weekend by Hamas in exchange for 183 Palestinian prisoners. His niece, Tal Wax.
You can see that Keith has been for 484 days in captivity. He's lost a lot of weight.
Later this month, Israel and Hamas will begin negotiating a second phase of a ceasefire. It's a stunning trade in the National Basketball Association. Sports reporter Erica Herskowitz has details of a trade involving one of the league's brightest stars.
Luka Doncic now joining LeBron James in Los Angeles and Anthony Davis teaming up with Kyrie Irving in Dallas. It also reunites Doncic with Lakers head coach and former Mavericks teammate J.J. Redick. Evidently, Dallas was motivated to move Doncic because of concerns over his conditioning.
This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Brittany Merlot with WXCO News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section on the WXCO website at BullFallsRadio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. One of the biggest stories of the past week has been the federal funding freeze. While the original memo has been rescinded, the Trump administration still intends to carry it out, causing panic for social services and governments everywhere, including Wisconsin. Mike Moen reports.
The White House issued a memo that ordered agencies to temporarily pause all activities related to the distribution of federal financial assistance. Officials stress it's meant for programs to show their priorities align with the new administration and that direct aid from things like Social Security and SNAP won't be disrupted. But Richard Fiesta with the Alliance for Retired Americans notes the psychological effect in this part of the U.S.
It would be much more important to have these programs on time and ready to go rather than this chaos we're seeing.
A judge on Tuesday temporarily blocked the pause from taking effect, but that order only lasts until Monday. Democrats and even some Republicans in Congress took issue with the administration's actions amid questions about legal authority. And those criticizing the move say as the situation plays out, even a temporary pause in funding could be very harmful to services like Head Start and suicide prevention hotlines. Fiesta worries some programs could look very different after agencies are reviewed by White House budget leaders.
We could see much more strain on the healthcare system in general, on hospitals. You could see a ripple effect because of inability to get care.
He points to Medicaid playing a big role in funding rural health care networks, including nursing home costs. Policy experts say drastic cuts, no matter how they're carried out, could put more pressure on state budgets. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some light snow and flurries early. Otherwise, our skies will eventually turn partly cloudy with highs in the mid-40s. A west wind will develop. Snow moves back into the picture tonight, 1 to 2, perhaps 3 inches by dawn. Lows in the mid-20s. Right now, it's 31.
Dom Salvia.
Next time, our favorite Delano Democrat Harvey K. joins to reflect on the legacy of the birthday boys Thomas Paine and FDR. Also, will tariffs on Canada and Mexico lower prices for Wisconsinites? Tune in.
The Dom Salvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, indeed, this is once again Amicus, a law review. This is, as you know well, our weekly weekend review, our analysis, our discussion of those major news stories in the areas of law and government, the aspiration for justice, and yes, indeed, the rule of law in Wisconsin, throughout the United States of America, and on the face of this planet. As always, I am honored, I am delighted to have you join me this weekend for our examination of all of those issues and more. As always, we're tackling some of the most significant issues, and there is a lot. There is a lot from just this past week. And before we begin to talk about those things in the areas of justice and courts and government, we are mindful as we gather this weekend about the horrific events in Washington, D.C. just this past Wednesday. Passenger jet and a Black Hawk helicopter colliding in midair Wednesday evening, crashing into the Potomac River near Reagan National Airport. The president confirming late this past week that there were no survivors. The plane, an American Eagle flight regional jetliner, was carrying some 60 passengers, 4 crew members on a flight from Wichita, Kansas. Also, 3 soldiers aboard that U.S. Army Sikorsky H-60, Defense Department official told CBS News. Obviously, the investigation continues, the pursuit of the truth, what happened there. And we are mindful as we gather this weekend, as always, about the horrific deaths, the pain and the suffering suffered not only by the families, but the larger community that has now lost many people in this tragic incident there in Washington, D.C., and we are thoughtful about their lives, the lives lost, the things that could have been, and also about the things that will be with their family members as they continue to live their lives in the wake of this horrific tragedy. Also note, of course, that this is a matter for government attention. The National Transportation Safety Board, the Department of Transportation, our secretary, others necessarily focused on, again, what happened. What are the facts of the situation, the circumstances that caused this horrific crash immediately adjacent to the Potomac River? How did this happen? And indeed, there will be an awful lot of attention to government, the mechanisms whereby government oversees and regulates to the good, even in situations like this, our air, our traffic, our transportation systems generally. Undeniably, there will also be those times when this issue and others like it will be brought into the courts of America. We will continue to monitor all of that as we go forward in America in the wake of this latest and recent, after many, many years of no air crashes in America, most recent crash in our nation's history. We do live in a time when the Department of Justice continues to animate much of our attention here in the United States of America. And that includes some things that we ended in our last program, our last broadcast last weekend. And that is focusing upon this issue of pardons. Again, normally in the normal process, the regular process in the Department of Justice, this unit, this office called the Office of the Pardon Attorney, not established constitutionally, but under the rubric of providing some regularity, some common sense, some process for those people who would seek to invoke the president's authority under the Constitution to grant pardons, to grant clemency. This is the process. This is the office that reviews those applications, or at least has reviewed them in the past, to provide, again, some consistency and ultimately based upon some fundamental standards about the timing of these applications, about the merits of them, the things that commend them or don't commend them to the president, making recommendations to the White House about what should or should not happen on these various applications. We know that in the recent days of the Trump administration, that Donald Trump pardoned approximately 1,500, almost 1,600 January 6 rioters and granted clemency to many others, including Proud Boys and others who were responsible for organizing and supervising the events of January 6th. In the wake of that, some commentary in our last broadcast about the kind of pardons that these are not contemplated by the Constitution, that as we understand it, as James Madison wrote this particular provision, as we understand it in the Federalist Papers, an opportunity for the president to express mercy, to grant these kinds of special considerations to people who warrant it, not to excuse and not to forgive, and not certainly not to overlook the horrific, violent behaviors of this particular group of pardon recipients. We talked a lot about that in our last broadcast. It is significant to note that even in the wake of the granting of these pardons to these great many recipients by our current president just in recent days, at least 12 people pardoned by Donald Trump in his first term and, yes, recently in his second term, including two just last week, have since been rearrested by the police or otherwise are running afoul of law enforcement. All of that we know because of reporting about who these people are and what has happened in the wake of these pardons. What we know, of course, is that Donald Trump pardoned 238 people in his first term and did indeed pardon about 1,500, almost 1,600 Capitol rioters following his reelection and his retaking the White House just recently. At least 10 people pardoned between 2016 and 2021. Two people pardoned last week were charged again on new crimes after their presidential release from prison. A third Capitol rioter remains on the run from police due to a prior warrant. Now, what do we know about these people? Well, two Capitol rioters, again, have had run-ins with the police, one of them fatal, which, again, is tragedy, absolute human tragedy, within a week after being pardoned by the president. His name is Matthew Huddle. He was fatally shot by an officer after allegedly resisting arrest at a traffic stop in Indiana. According to some local police there, Huddle was apparently in possession of a firearm. And during the stop, that firearm and others used, unclear whether he attempted to use it during the arrest, but plainly, he was shot as a result of his encounter with police at that time. The second Capitol rioter to be arrested is Daniel Ball. He was taken into custody for a federal gun charge from 2023 shortly after his release from prison. Despite being pardoned over his actions on January 6th, where Ball allegedly did what? Well, he threw an explosive into the Capitol, causing hearing loss among police officers and also other injuries, which lasted for months. Ball still had a criminal record for domestic violence battery by strangulation in 2017 and resisting law enforcement with violence and battery in 2021, meaning that his possession of a .22-caliber rifle and ammunition put him in violation of federal gun laws. And there's a third Capitol rioter who's currently on the run from Texas police due to a pre-existing warrant from 2016, Andrew Taake, T-A-A-K-E, is wanted on charges of online solicitation of a minor.
despite the Harris County District Attorney asking the federal prison to keep Taki in custody. He was released and now is on the run from authorities. Those three recently in the wake of the pardons granted to them by the president of the United States of America. We will continue to monitor, of course, all those kinds of things related to pardons in America, the impact of them, and the diminution of the meaning of the pardon in our Constitution and in our national life. Also this weekend on Amicus, a law review, a deeper dive into all kinds of things happening inside the Department of Justice, things with respect to the Civil Rights Division, the cases that are being shut down or certainly suspended. I'm going to talk about some movements of attorneys previously within the Department of Justice with great authority into other areas where they're no longer, their expertise is no longer useful or no longer directly applicable. We'll talk about the movements inside a thing called the Honors Program and the cancellation of Honors Program attorneys for employment in the Department of Justice. We'll talk about the firing of some prosecutors by the White House, by the Department of Justice. Those prosecutors, where were they? They were inside, of course, the team that Jack Smith had assembled to prosecute the now present president for both insurrection related to January 6th, an attempt to overthrow the results of the 2020 election, but also that Mar-a-Lago documents case. Those attorneys were fired just recently. We'll talk recently about the decision by the present leadership of the Department of Justice to issue memorandums to all of the sitting United States attorneys, many of them in acting positions, to investigate and prosecute local and state law enforcement if they do not comply, if they do not comply with the mandates of the White House in connection with immigration policies. We'll talk about some reporting also that Eric Adams, the embattled New York mayor, charged in the federal system for corruption, for his conduct in office and his other conduct out of office. Discussions apparently going on inside the Department of Justice about whether or not to dismiss that case against him. We'll talk about some of the connections between Eric Adams and our current president. Then necessarily we're going to go down the street. We're going to go down to the Supreme Court once again and update what's been going on there in the United States Supreme Court, talking about some of the oral arguments on deck by the Department of Justice in recent weeks, including cases involving things like excessive force by the police. We'll talk about how the oral argument in that particular case played out in recent times. We'll talk about the decision of the Supreme Court upholding a money laundering ruling, a money laundering policy, a practice, a statute. It's going to affect, again, the ways in which prosecutors address money laundering and some other cases as well. Give you a sense of how many cases there are pending, what's going to be going on in the month of February as well. And then, of course, we also will update you on a couple of other things related to justice and the law, rule of law. Rudy Giuliani recently settling his major case involving that defamation of his against two Georgia workers. Millions of dollars settled recently to bring him out from under the pressure, the contempt of the court. We'll talk about that case and also the recent sentencing. Yes, that's right. A former Senator Bob Menendez, 11 years in prison based upon his corruption as alleged and proven in a federal court in Manhattan. All of that and more coming up here on Amicus Law Review as we talk about these things that happen in the midst of an administration that continues to surprise and distress and dismay many Americans for the ways in which they're issuing executive orders, rescinding them. All of that also a part of the rule of law. Why? Because decisions and executive orders by the president, depending upon their status and their legal status as well, are also matters for the law, matters for all of us to be attentive to here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media and Amicus, a law review. Stay with us.
You're listening to Bow Falls Radio WXCO, Wausau's home for Up North News Radio.
It's the most competitive sport for all to enjoy, and Milwaukee is even the capital for it. It's bowling, and the oldest bowling alley is in Wisconsin. Holler House is home to the two oldest sanctioned lanes in the U.S. and are still made of the wood installed in 1908. The building on West Lincoln in Milwaukee looks the same. Musicians Joe Walsh and Jack White have thrown a ball down those 115-year-old lanes. Now, can you guess the tradition that continues here to this day? A hot beef sandwich, just 25 cents. The pins still set by people? Swear, and you're tossed out. The answer coming up. The fifth and sixth generations run Holler House, so some odd history does remain, like bras hanging from the rafters. The alleys have even been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Sports Illustrated. So what's your guess about the continuing tradition? It's the pins still being set by people. No machines here. These stories make it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Jerry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. For this hour and next hour here on this first weekend broadcast of the new month, doing a deeper dive into things we have not talked about with great particularity recently. That is the Department of Justice, things going on inside the Department of Justice, even as America anticipates the arrival of a new attorney general, her name Pam Bondi. The arrival, likely, of a new director of the FBI, his name Kash Patel, having gone recently through those processes, the advice and consent process, which is required of these appointees through our Constitution. Meanwhile, the Department of Justice still going on, still operating, and in many ways doing things that, yes, are part of an interim and a transfer kind of process inside the Department of Justice, but things that nonetheless affect the ways in which we understand the law in America, even in this transitional period as we change administrations. Let's talk about a number of those, four or five, maybe even six of them, that are going on right now inside the U.S. Department of Justice. Main Justice on 9th and Constitution there in Washington, D.C., but also in U.S. Attorney's offices, the 93 U.S. Attorney's offices around the country. Right here, two of them in Wisconsin, the Eastern District of Wisconsin, which has an office in Milwaukee, and also in Green Bay, and then also the Western District of Wisconsin, which has an office principally in Madison, responsible for enforcing the federal law in our local districts based upon directives and encouragement and instruction given to the U.S. attorneys by the Attorney General and right now by the acting people who are in charge at Main Justice. Let's talk about something that's happened just recently. This coming out from the chief of staff at the department named Chad Mizell. Justice Department has ordered an immediate halt to all new civil rights cases or investigations. Yes, you heard that right. All new civil rights cases or investigations. And also signaled along the way in that same missive, that same directive, that it might well back out of some Biden-era agreements with police departments to do what? To remedy some engagement that they've had with discrimination or violence. And all that comes to us from two internal memorandums sent through the Department of Justice in the wake of Donald Trump taking the White House and beginning to install the Trump employees there. The first of those two short memos from the Department of Justice ordered a litigation freeze at the Civil Rights Division. My former boss, Eric Holder, often spoke about the Civil Rights Division as providing the heart and the soul of the department. It's how you can measure the integrity of the department and the people responsible for it. And the directive in particular is that freeze applies to the initiation of any new cases in the Civil Rights Division. It also barred lawyers in the division from working and from filing motions to intervene, agreed upon so-called remands. Cases are going from one court to another.
amicus briefs, which, of course, as you know, are friend of the court briefs, statements of history, interest, all these kinds of things that would articulate the positions of the present administration inside pending litigation. All of that suspended in the midst of continuing litigation until and if there is approval that's received by senior Trump appointments. And it is plainly the clearest sign yet that the Trump administration is taking over the department and intending to move swiftly, as it is plainly in many, many other areas of government these days. In addition to this significant halting of new cases and new case litigation movements, perhaps even more significant, there's a second memo that orders a similar freeze on department activity across the board, Civil Rights Division, involving so-called consent decrees. Now, we've talked a lot about these things in the past. Those are those agreements that are hashed out typically between local governments and others to address some police practices that have run afoul of the commitment of police officers to serve and provide support to all of us. Could be based upon identified practices that are race-based, based upon ethnicity or gender, sexual orientation, disabilities of the people that the police are intended to serve. We've seen those in a lot of different cities around the nation. And indeed, during the Biden administration, an awful lot of focus on putting those consent decrees in place. They have different kinds of iterations, different kinds of formats. But the whole idea is to try to establish a new format, a new set of policies and practices inside a particular police department to address the woes and the errors and the faults of the past. The new administration may wish to reconsider those settlements and consent decrees negotiated and approved during the prior administration. That's what the chief of staff wrote. The order could, of course, scuttle agreements reached recently with the Louisville, Kentucky Police Department. You recall that. That was in the wake of the killing of Breonna Taylor. There was that Minneapolis decree in the aftermath, of course, of the George Floyd murder as well. Neither has received final approval by a federal judge. That's a part of the process, too. And there are plainly other voluntary agreements, consent agreements. These are agreements between the police and the Department of Justice that could likewise be jeopardized by this decision to stop all of them from going ahead. The president has nominated Harmeet Dhillon, a lawyer from California, to serve as the chief of the Civil Rights Division. Ms. Dhillon, who will be responsible again for things like these police cases, all kinds of civil rights cases in the areas of housing and voting and academics and access to the basic trappings of our lives, all of that under the rubric and the supervision of Ms. Dhillon coming up when she is approved by the Senate and takes her position. She, in the past, not only a major figure in the state Republican Party in California, which does not disqualify her by any means, but also supporting Donald Trump's false claims of voter fraud. Voter fraud. That's the incoming civil rights chief in our United States Department of Justice. We know as well that there have also been some significant movements of attorneys inside the Department of Justice. Let's talk about one version of that. Many of the attorneys who previously worked inside the Civil Rights Division told, again, these are civil servants. These are not political appointees, told that they're now going to be moved to different units of the Department of Justice, no longer working in these civil rights areas. Many of them directed to become a part of a new entity, a new division, a new initiative that's going to focus on sanctuary cities and determining whether those sanctuary cities, you know what they are, you know what this process is all about, whether they themselves are in violation of the president's policies and practices when it comes to these kind of initiatives. And so all of that coming up here on Amicus Law Review as we talk more about employment inside the Department of Justice here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
Civic Media.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, home of the Chad Holmes Show.
CBS News Brief. Americans are bracing for the possibility of higher prices for products from Canada, Mexico, and China after President Trump imposed tariffs beginning this Tuesday. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
A lot of people at the Super Bowl have beer and guac. Much of it comes from Mexico, and the prices of these things are likely to go up.
Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner is complaining about some of his constituents being pressured to resign by the Office of Personnel Management.
OPM does not have that authority to start with. That was who it came from.
Right.
But it is, I can tell you, with lots of federal employees, we got chaos on steroids going on.
He was on Face the Nation. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is defending President Trump's decision to use the U.S. base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to house undocumented migrants.
Having facilities at Guantanamo Bay will be an asset to us, and the fact that we'll have the capacity to continue to do there what we've always done.
See you was on NBC. CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
It was a big Saturday in college hoops. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cuska with Civic Media Sports. First, it was the Wisconsin Badgers rallying in the second half to take down Northwestern 75-69 yesterday. John Tonjay led the 17th-ranked Badgers with 27 points in the win, which puts Wisconsin in a three-way tie for fourth place in the Big Ten. Wisconsin will get Indiana on Tuesday night in Madison. Then, it was a top 25 showdown in Milwaukee last night on National Marquette Day. 9th-ranked Marquette never led against number 25 UConn, with UConn leading by as many as 22 points in a 77-69 win. Cam Jones had 22 points for Marquette, which will play at St. John's on Tuesday. Tonight, the Milwaukee Bucks will try to avoid their third straight loss as they take on the Memphis Grizzlies. The Bucks have now fallen to fifth place in the Eastern Conference. Tip time is at 7:30. The NBA was rocked by a major trade last night as the Los Angeles Lakers swapped Anthony Davis for Luka Doncic of the Dallas Mavericks in a three-team, seven-player blockbuster deal. It's the first time that a midseason trade has included two players named All-NBA in the previous season. For Civic Media Sports, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price of light snow and flurries early. Otherwise, our skies will eventually turn partly cloudy with highs in the mid-40s. A west wind will develop. Snow moves back into the picture tonight, 1 to 2, perhaps 3 inches by dawn. Lows in the mid-20s. It's 33 at our studios.
This message is sponsored by WiscCaregiver.com. People across Wisconsin are enjoying the rewards, stability, and flexibility of a career in healthcare. Why not you? WiscCaregiver.com gets you started. Choose between two great options. Become a CDCP, Certified Direct Care Professional, or a CNA, Certified Nurse Aide. Training is free, plus earn a $500 bonus. It's easy to start your new career. Learn more at WiscCaregiver.com.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Last April, federal cybersecurity agency CISA issued warnings to election officials on how to combat a Russian online scheme to mislead American voters in the 2024 election. CISA is now under attack by its own administration. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency Act was signed by President Donald Trump in 2018, with part of its mission to protect election systems. It played a vital role in hardening state and local computer systems prior to the 2024 election, supporting state election officials, and monitoring hacking and disinformation campaigns perpetrated by Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. After the 2020 election, it refuted Trump's false claims that the 2020 election was manipulated. Trump fired its director, and CISA was targeted by Project 2025 for a dramatic overhaul, with some conservatives calling for the agency's elimination. Just before inauguration, President Biden issued an executive order requiring new CISA cybersecurity standards be implemented, but Trump immediately revoked it January 20th. CISA's highly qualified director, Jen Easterly, resigned on Inauguration Day. New Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, said in her confirmation hearing, CISA had strayed from its mission by monitoring disinformation. As governor of South Dakota, she refused federal funding to harden cyber systems, calling it wasteful spending. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Emily Zippos is back as my guest co-host. We're going to talk about Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Brian Hagedorn recusing himself from an Act 10 lawsuit. What does that mean? Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. Reviewing recent events inside the Department of Justice, even at this time of transition, talking about these major decisions to suspend the work of one of the most critically important divisions inside the Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division, that again has a rich history in terms of supporting the civil rights of Americans in all states of our union, and then talking as well about ways in which the Civil Rights Division will perhaps forever be changed under the, at least under this administration, moving attorneys who are experienced, who know what they're doing, who've handled these kinds of cases in the area of voting rights and housing and education and healthcare, all kinds of things, moving them out of their areas of expertise into other units. Now, they still have the skills to be litigation lawyers. They're superb. They are civil servants. They are not political employees, but moved at the direction, presumably, of the present leadership, such as it is at the Department of Justice, and probably by the Department of, by the United States White House as well. Directives from the White House to the U.S. Department of Justice, some of them being moved into a new initiative to determine whether or not so-called sanctuary cities, places where people who are in immigration status can find sanctuary and protection, whether those kinds of actions by cities adopted by city councils and by mayors, whether those should be the subject of investigations and prosecutions, that's where some of these attorneys have now been moved, I'm certain, much to their chagrin and to their dismay. We know as well that there's another thing that's happened inside the Department of Justice, and that is with respect to something called the Honors Program. It is accessible on the Department of Justice website. This is a mechanism through which the best attorneys, typically young attorneys coming out of law school, coming out of clerkships, were interested in doing the work of the Department of Justice, civil litigation, criminal litigation, mainly at the Department of Justice, but sometimes in the U.S. Attorney's offices around the country. A mechanism for identifying them, bringing into them into the fold, training them in a way that will ensure that the future of the Department of Justice is secure. That honors program almost completely decimated in recent days. Notices sent out to the incoming honors program attorneys at the Department of Justice that the offers previously made to them to be placed in various positions, not just in civil rights, but in other areas, in the civil division, the tax division, the antitrust division, the environment and natural resources division, the criminal division, the national security division, all kinds of divisions, litigating divisions inside the Department of Justice. Their offers, the best and the brightest people coming in, all of those rescinded by this present administration. We'll see what happens with the honors program in the future if it is resurrected in some way, but that too, a way of changing dramatically not just the composition, but also the very texture, the very way in which the Department of Justice operates on a regular basis. And then there's this. Then there is also this. News coming out of the Washington, D.C. groups just this past week and coming out from the White House in particular and the Department of Justice. President Donald Trump's administration has begun to fire those lawyers who prosecuted him. Perhaps not surprisingly, but nonetheless, it is still stunning to see. Officials were fired after acting attorney general, his name is James McHenry, he is there until Pam Bondi is confirmed and takes her oath of office, concluded that these particular attorneys who brought these cases, the two federal cases against Donald Trump, they once again are the insurrection case. That was a case in front of Tanya Chutkan. You remember that well. That dismissed recently by the prior administration by Jack Smith before he left, and also that other case pending in South Florida. That was the documents case, the classified documents case pending in front of Eileen Cannon. The attorneys involved in this mass firing were the attorneys who were prosecuting the cases against the principal defendant in both of those, his name, Donald Trump. The officials, again, were fired after the acting attorney general concluded, quote, that they could not be trusted to faithfully implement the president's agenda because of their significant role in prosecuting the president. That's what the present attorney general said in firing these attorneys who were responsible as civil servants for bringing the law to courts and bringing these presentations to grand juries before judges, ultimately doing their jobs. McHenry cited Trump's power as the chief executive under the Constitution to justify the firings. The lawyers again worked with special counsel Jack Smith during his years-long term. He led once again those two principal criminal federal cases. News of these firings came the same day that Ed Martin, who's the U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C. and also a Trump appointee, opened an internal investigation, an internal review into the use of the felony obstruction charge in prosecutions of people accused of taking part in the January 6th riot, the insurrection at the United States Capitol. You may recall this. We talked about this long ago on this very broadcast. This is the case involving Fisher. He was one of the thousands of people charged with violations of federal law. And the question was whether or not the particular statute under which he was prosecuted could indeed be applied to people under his circumstances. The court, by a split court, determined in the end that the invocation of this particular statute was not rational, not based, not at all a thing upon which there was unanimity inside the Supreme Court. The United States attorney now investigating whether or not those who used that statute, they themselves should be investigated and if some action should be taken against them. We know as well that all of this happening, as I mentioned already, that some 20 senior career Justice Department attorneys, including a fellow named Bradley Weinsheimer, the top ethics official and the former chief of the public corruption section. His name is Corey Admonson. And again, moved from their roles as a part of this attempt to change dramatically the Department of Justice, the way that it works, the people who inhabit that place. The workforce shakeup there is not unanticipated. It certainly comes with anticipation in some areas that all U.S. attorneys, again, who are not civil servants. When I was U.S. attorney, I understood well that becoming a presidentially appointed U.S. attorney, you are no longer protected by the civil service. That, yes, indeed, we anticipate that U.S. attorneys and others in top positions at the Department of Justice who are these political appointees will, in fact, be changed. The concern here is the movement of the transfer of these longtime civil servants who know what they're doing, who've got the expertise in these areas, stopping them from doing the work that they have done so well under all kinds of administrations, not just the Biden administration, but frankly, under prior administrations of both Republicans and Democrats, stopping them from doing that. When Pam Bondi comes in, when Kash Patel comes in as the chief of the FBI, presumably they will have some significant power now in assigning people inside the Department of Justice, making some political appointments, again, through the presidency, but also making significant decisions about the emphasis of the Department of Justice. And plainly, one of the messages coming out of these recent firings, these recent movements of attorneys inside the Department of Justice, is we're about to see a Department of Justice of the sort that we have not seen in a very long time, if ever. We'll continue to monitor all of this, of course. We'll also continue to monitor something else that reflects upon the change in approach by the Department of Justice. And yes, indeed, this impacts directly those 93 U.S. attorneys around our nation. A directive issued just recently by an individual whose name we know well. His name is Emile Beauvais. He sat next to the president as late as just 3 weeks ago when the president was finally being sentenced in that Manhattan courtroom for his 34 violations of state law in Manhattan, violations of those false statements, those fraudulent representation counts. Emile Beauvais, among the defense team for Donald Trump, his personal attorney, now taking his role for a while as the acting deputy attorney general. Ultimately, he'll become another high-ranking official inside the Department of Justice. He's a former member of the president's criminal defense team, and he is now issuing also memorandums inside the Department of Justice This one, sending messages to all United States attorneys. It's a 3-page memorandum. It was issued the week before last. It's intended to provide guidance, which memorandums of this sort can and indeed often do, not unusual for any Department of Justice, any deputy attorney general, any attorney general to issue directives generally to U.S. attorneys and to others inside the Department of Justice about emphasis and about direction, without directing particular prosecutions, without telling particular U.S. attorneys who to indict and who not to indict. In this 3-page memorandum, guidance to all department employees, including especially U.S. attorneys, interim leaders, continuing U.S. attorneys around the country to do what? To investigate and, yes, indeed, as appropriate, prosecute criminally law enforcement officials who decline to enforce the immigration policies and practices announced by the White House. The memo commands state and local officials to cooperate with the department under the Constitution's Supremacy Clause. We know what that's all about, the supremacy of federal law over state law, or face criminal prosecution or perhaps civil penalties if they fail to comply. Of course, all of this as a part of the president's and, yes, indeed, the Department of Justice's incredible focus, perhaps beyond any other focus on immigration issues. The law, the criminal law, the federal law here that is invoked in this memorandum, according to Emilio Bay, prohibits state and local actors from resisting, obstructing, and otherwise failing to comply with lawful immigration-related commands. That's what Emile Beauvais wrote in this policy. And again, a lot of pushback on this policy because, of course, it's the federal government that's principally responsible for the enforcement of immigration law. And that too is where? That is in the Constitution of the United States of America. We have had some pushback already. You've got a spokesman for the Attorney General. His name is Phil Weiser in Colorado. He says, as far as we know, no state or local officials are obstructing immigration enforcement. He said the federal government, and he's right about this, not local law enforcement, is responsible for enforcing federal immigration laws. Governor Katie Hobbs of Arizona, she said the memo was a distraction. She added, I refuse to let political games get in the way of ensuring the safety and the security of every Arizonan. All of those kinds of things coming out of Washington, but also coming out of state and local officials responding to this. And again, as a part of the general approach of law enforcement, local, state, and federal, the great concern, aside from the threats of criminal prosecution and investigation, if you do not comply, if you do not fall in line with the White House's policies on immigration, is the wedge that this will send in between federal and state and local law enforcement. It is a part of the practice under all previous administrations that local law enforcement gets together and decides how to prosecute, how to investigate cases. That's good law enforcement, task forces, groups of people coming together from different jurisdictions to discuss the ways in which they can keep the state of Wisconsin, the state of New York, the United States of America safe and secure, using limited resources, coming together, quite literally sitting around a table and not just negotiating, but cooperating and figuring out ways with limited resources, but with focuses upon our safety and security. How do you do that best? Well, when you're sitting around a table where one of the participants, namely the U.S. attorney, has been directed to investigate or prosecute somebody who is on the left or right side of that U.S. attorney because they're not in compliance with what the president wants in terms of the federal enforcement of law, that sends a wedge. And that chills all law enforcement. Offer that the memorandum, presumably given the imprimatur by the White House, but issued by Emile Beauvais, who will continue to be a major player in the Department of Justice even after all the leadership is in place. This memorandum, again, changes the ways in which local and state law enforcement interact with federal law enforcement, not to the good. All of that happening inside the Department of Justice these days. And yet a footnote coming out just recently to all of this, having to do with the mayor of the city of New York. His name, of course, is Eric Adams. As Amicus Law Review continues, we'll talk about something else that's going inside the Department of Justice as to that criminal case against him. Stay with us here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
Hey, it's family time at Chula Vista with the right kind of fun for everyone. Wisconsin's most complete resort experience has everything you want. Fine-tuned for 70 years by four generations of the Kaminsky family. Chula Vista can be easygoing with colorful scenic river walks, a rejuvenating spa visit, relaxing at outdoor fire pits, or you can go all out in 80,000 square feet of indoor water park and outdoors with cross-country skiing, sledding, and snowshoeing. Dining comes any way you like it, from pizza to Wisconsin's number one ranked steakhouse. More than 600 guest rooms to choose from with $10 million in updates. Chula Vista, everything you've been wanting, all right here, on site. Check it out at ChulaVistaResort.com.
Discover Chula's Winter Wonderland. Miles of freshly groomed trails, skiing, sledding, snowshoeing. Check out bonus gift cards at ChulaVistaResort.com.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio WXCO, home of the big high school sports show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this, the remaining moments of this first hour, and yes, the second hour, in which we're also going to be talking a lot about the United States Supreme Court. Some cases pending in our federal courts around the nation. But returning here to the things that are going on inside your Department of Justice right now, in addition to all of the significant personnel moves, the firing of prosecutors, the movement of longstanding civil rights attorneys, the changes in the Civil Rights Division, this directive from the Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General to investigate and prosecute local and state law enforcement if they don't comply with the directives of the White House, all of that going on. Well, there are also being some decisions made having to do with particular cases that are pending out there coming over from the Biden administration, things initiated during that term. You recall well this prosecution against the mayor of the city of New York. His name is Eric Adams. He was indicted in September, you will recall, on charges including bribery and fraud and soliciting illegal foreign campaign contributions. That, of course, in the wake of an investigation that began way back in 2021, he has pled guilty. We will do as we always do. We will affirm that he is innocent until proven guilty. And indeed, Mayor Adams has maintained his innocence and contended that he is being prosecuted because he criticized the Biden administration's immigration policies, even as New York was receiving a significant influx of migrants. We know that from the news as well. Federal prosecutors have consistently rebuffed this and said, no, this is based upon the facts. This is based upon the facts presented to a grand jury that decided in the end that there is probable cause to believe that the mayor of the city of New York has engaged in all of that. In recent weeks, of course, you also know from the news that Eric Adams has certainly curried some favor with Donald Trump. He has met with the president-elect near Mar-a-Lago. He attended the inauguration. Nothing wrong with any of that. And has said from now on, he will share any criticisms of the president in private. Nothing wrong with any of that, but it gives rise to concerns about whether or not the decisions that may be moving forward on Eric Adams' prosecution, the criminal case against him, might be animated once again by the president of the United States of America. According to several people, the mayor and the president have been in direct communication for weeks. They speak on the phone. After a meeting in West Palm Beach not too long ago, they did not discuss a pardon, apparently by all accounts. But Donald Trump did speak about a weaponized Justice Department, and he has described Eric Adams having been mistreated as he himself was, according to the president, as a result of the weaponization of the Justice Department. The U.S. attorney there in the Southern District of New York. Her name is Danielle Sassoon. She's a veteran prosecutor. She was selected by the Trump administration. She, again, is responsible for overseeing all of this. And the news, of course, of just this past week that is not yet definitive, not yet certain, but news coming out of reliable sources of the Department of Justice that some senior Justice Department officials in this new administration are holding discussions with federal prosecutors in Manhattan, including the U.S. attorney there, about the possibility of dropping that corruption case against Mayor Eric Adams. It's according to a number of people with knowledge of this matter. The reporting, a lot of it coming out from the New York Times, indicates that they have spoken to Eric Adams' defense team since Donald Trump took office. The defense team, led by a fellow named Alex Spiro, who is also the personal lawyer for a fellow named Elon Musk. You've heard a lot about him in recent years. Elon Musk, of course, the richest man on the face of the planet, one of the president's closest advisors. The attorney for Elon Musk is also on the defense team for Eric Adams. Now, apparently, the subject of some discussions about whether or not the criminal case against him should be dropped in the future. That's significant coming out of, again, without certainty, coming out of reliable sources in the Department of Justice, perhaps bringing an end to that prosecution against the mayor of the city of New York. We know as well that just in recent days, federal prosecutors have also dropped the last remaining efforts to prosecute Donald Trump's two remaining co-defendants in that classified documents case brought by, yes, Jack Smith, who's the special counsel. Single-page filing. Prosecutors have asked a federal appeals court, that's the 11th Circuit in Atlanta, to dismiss the remaining portions, the vestiges of this case, this appeal that had been filed before Donald Trump took office, that was seeking to reinstate criminal charges against these two men. Their names, you may recall, are Walt Nauta and Carlos de Oliveira. The two of them had been added on to the indictment by Jack Smith long before the election, long before any of these other things happened, based upon charges that they'd engaged in obstruction of justice in the government's repeated efforts to retrieve these documents, to find out where they are, to get them back. All of this a part of that prosecution, dismissed by the federal district court judge, ultimately resulting in the United States Department of Justice dismissing the case entirely as to Donald Trump. And now under the new administration, as to these two remaining defendants, these co-defendants in that case, the prosecutor is moving the 11th Circuit, which is the last portion of this case, to dismiss that case against those co-defendants, Walt Nauta and Carlos de Oliveira. It is significant, of course, because this will bring to an end this long and storied history of these cases against Donald Trump and others in his ambit. We know that at least one of these, Walt Nauta, continues to be a close associate of the president, apparently also involved in employment at the White House to this time. It appears that the 11th Circuit will almost certainly grant that motion to dismiss this case against him, once again bringing this case, like all others, to an end. We know that because of past history, and we know about the processes by which these matters go forward in our federal courts. More about federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court, in our second hour as Amicus, a Law Review, continues.
Falls Radio, WXCO.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Wisconsin-based comedian Eli Pills and Nightlight frequent flyer, musician, producer, and founder of Wisconsinology.com, Frank Anderson. We're going to light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
Yamato, the drummers of Japan return to the Grand Theater in Wausau with their Power of Human Strength tour. Experience the explosive energy of these talented musicians when they take the stage on Friday, March 7th. With more than 40 different taiko drums, Yamato engulfs the audience in energetic sound.
Yamato. Tickets at grandtheater.org.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Christopher Cruz. Canadian leaders don't know what to make of President Trump's imposition of 25% tariffs on many Canadian goods beginning Tuesday. Kristen Hillman is Canada's ambassador to the United States.
Canadians are perplexed, I think disappointed. We view ourselves as your neighbor, your closest friend, your ally.
She was on ABC. Canada says it will impose 25% retaliatory tariffs on American goods. On NBC, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said the tariffs are being imposed in part to pressure Canada to strengthen its border security.
The president has been very clear from the beginning that there's a new sheriff in town, that he's going to make sure he's putting Americans first, and that Canada can help us, or they can get in the way, and they will face the consequences of it.
How could the tariffs affect us? Here's Gas Buddy's Patrick DeHaan.
Not only is this going to cause consumers probably pay more in the areas of anywhere from 5 to 25 cents a gallon, and potentially more, but the also risks of retaliation are significant that could further drive up fuel prices for many Americans.
Former senior FBI officials are reacting with alarm to a reported purge of agents by the Trump administration. Retired FBI Assistant Director Frank Figliuzzi was on CBS's Face the Nation.
With regard to dismissing hundreds or thousands of special agents in the field who have touched January 6 cases or Trump-related cases, this makes America less safe.
In Panama today, Secretary of State Marco Rubio warned officials that the U.S. may take action if they don't make immediate changes to the operations of the Panama Canal. He says Panama has violated the terms of the treaty that gave it control of the canal.